10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
My morning show guest, E. Dolores Johnson, was born in the late 1940s to a mother who was white and a father who was black, at a time when such racially mixed marriages were illegal in a number of states across the country, and such marriages were frowned upon by a large swath of the American population, including both blacks and whites. E. Dolores Johnson's experience of growing up in such a family and her own experience as someone of mixed race are chronicled in a powerful and poignant new memoir called Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. We are airing it on Juneteenth, the day that celebrates the end of slavery in the United States, and airing it exactly 1 week after Loving Day, which celebrates the end of anti-miscegenation laws in the United States. I asked E. Dolores Johnson to chronicle for us the history of anti-miscegenation laws. Those are the laws which forbade racially mixed marriages.
In the very earliest days of the colonies, I'm talking about the 1600s, when slaves arrived here in 1619, there was certainly a separation of the races. There was to be no race mixing in people's minds. And by the time 150 years had passed and slavery was completely embedded in everything about America's economy and value system, black people were written into the Constitution as three-fifths of a person. Later on, Virginia created a theory called the one-drop rule that said, if you have one drop of Negro blood in you, you're a Negro. The theory being that the white race had to be preserved as a pure 100% European heritage. And laws went on the books in 28 states in the 1700s and 1800s that were anti-miscegenation laws. Miscegenation means intermarriage. And that included not only marriage with white people marrying African Americans, but also Native Americans, Mexicans, Chinese, anybody who wasn't white. And so this country has always kept that white supremacist understanding of who it is, that people of color are the outsiders. By the time that my parents got married, there were still quite a few states, including Indiana, where they were, that had penalties for both parties, women and men, of prison terms at hard labor. And they met in 1942. And the Loving decision, which is the landmark Supreme Court decision that overturned all remaining anti-miscegenation laws, happened in 1967, when they had already been married 25 years. And in that decision, the remaining 15 or 16 states in America that still forbid race mixing, that set of laws was challenged by a couple whose last name happened to be Loving. A black woman and a white man from Virginia went across the line into District of Columbia and got married legally, and then went back to Virginia where they were from and set up housekeeping. And in the middle of the night, the police came and broke the door down and arrested them. And the punishment that the judge meted out was that they would be banished from the state of Virginia for 25 years, or they could go to prison. And when the Supreme Court heard their case, that's when they abolished all anti-miscegenation laws remaining in America.
Incredible. It's just incredible to imagine such a world, particularly because even though, of course, there is still so much that needs to be done when it comes to matters of race and justice, this seems to be one area in which the practices of the past have fallen away to an amazing extent. I mean, I'm sure there are still people in this country, probably still places in this country, where there are grave reservations about the notion of mixed marriage. But by and large, this concern has largely vanished, at least from kind of the forefront of American life.
I think there has been a tremendous progress all the way from slavery time, where the first mixed race people were created by plantation rapes, through the Jim Crow era that my parents faced, to today when the census reports 1 in 10 marriages in the United States are mixed race, and that's all races, not just black and white. And in the 2010 report, the census stated that the growth rate in births for mixed race children was 3 times the rate of growth for single race children. And they trend that out into the mid-2000s and say that America is moving towards a 20% population of mixed race people. And so you're right, there has been a lot of movement, but it still remains complicated. It still can be very difficult. There are still people who can't abide the thought.
Hmm. We're speaking with E. Dolores Johnson. We are talking today about her memoir, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. E. Dolores Johnson's parents were a mixed couple. Her father was black, her mother was white. And so this memoir is about their life together, and in particular some of the difficult decisions that that Dolores Johnson's mother made regarding her own family. And this memoir is also about E. Dolores Johnson's own life as someone of mixed race, trying to sort out who she was. Let's talk about your parents, and maybe you could share with our family, maybe you could share with our listeners a little bit about how the two of them met, and how the two of them, of course, ultimately fell in love.
My parents met at work in 1942. My mother was the mail clerk in the mailroom, and my dad was the handyman who was sent down to build shelves for her to put her packages and sort her envelopes and so forth. And when my mother saw him, she thought, well, he was such a decent, nice man, so well-spoken and well-groomed. He was nothing like what she had heard black people were like. There were, you know, widely held beliefs at that time that black people were dirty and ignorant and violent, and he had nothing in him that seemed to support that commonly held notion. And so she spoke with him as she would anyone and made everyday conversation, which is something he could hardly believe, because normally he was an invisible person in white company. Just go there and serve their purpose and disappear. That's how many black people still live today. As you may have noticed during coronavirus, we have just now discovered that all these essential workers that kept the economy going are the people that we barely notice in the supermarket and the office cleaning crew and back office people at the hospital. But my dad was very taken with my mom. He thought that she was just the loveliest and sweetest person. And when he asked her if she would see him outside of work, she agreed, but they made a plan to do so in secret, because he told her, if we are seen in public together, I'm going to get lynched. And it wasn't an idle comment, because there had been a lynching of two men in Indiana before they took up. Two men who were lynched in part because a white woman claimed that they had raped her. And after they were dead, she recanted and said it never happened. Mm-hmm. And many lynchings in this country, the 4,000 lynchings that took place, were based on some sort of story about black men and white women. And so it was a completely, completely taboo arrangement that the two of them made in seeing each other in secret. But when they decided that they were serious, my dad said to her, listen, I don't think you really understand. I don't think you really know that you are in danger when you're with me. And he told her, not only could I be beaten up or lynched, we'd both be fired from our jobs, and your name would be ruined. You would be shunned by all white people for what you're doing here with me. Do you actually understand what you're doing? And she didn't. She told him that in her family, Negro business had never been their business, that they lived in a white community, their social circle was all white, they were socially active through their white Catholic parish. They didn't know black people. They'd heard these ugly rumors about black people, but she said, you know, that business about the lynching that he explained to her, she said, I wouldn't have ever been told that. That wouldn't be conversation to have with a young lady at my house. So no, I didn't know any of this. So he told her, you go away now and think about what I've told you and try to understand if our relationship is worth it to you for all that you'd have to give up and endure. And if you don't come back, I'll understand. But she did. She came back.
It's really incredible to think about two human beings. I mean, the decision to marry is momentous enough under the simplest of situations or circumstances. But to think of weighing such a possibility against this kind of backdrop, which in which what they were contemplating doing was it was a matter of breaking the law where they lived. So explain to our listeners then what they did upon the decision that they would indeed get married.
My dad explained to her that there was no way they could stay in Indianapolis. The Klan was running the city government. The law said they couldn't get married. And there had been that lynching. So he said to her, if we are going to get married, we have got to leave here. We can't get married here under any of those circumstances. And when we go, you can't tell your parents where we are. You will have to cut ties with your family, because they both knew that her mother would have never allowed such a thing to happen. She would have called the police, and my father said, we can't have the law chasing us wherever we go and living in that fear, so you're going to have to basically go underground and never contact your family again. And so my mother made a ruse, and she told her dad that she was going to visit an old classmate in Massachusetts, and he put her on the train. You know, having said to her initially, I don't think you should travel alone. A young lady shouldn't travel by herself that distance. But she insisted, and he said to her, okay, well, we'll see you, you know, in a few days or weeks when you come back. You know, we'll be waiting for you. And she disappeared into thin air. When she didn't call home, they contacted the girl in Massachusetts who said she didn't know anything about such a vacation plan. And then they searched throughout Indianapolis and Indiana for anyone that might know where she was or anything that might have happened to her, and came up empty-handed. And so the FBI was called in, because my mom had stopped in New York City. The plan was to meet my dad in New York. He had gone on ahead of her by some time. And when he got there, he was planning to get a job working the docks, but he had developed a hernia and couldn't do that work, and he left New York and went to Buffalo, where his mom lived. So when my mom arrived in New York, she called the only number she had, which was his mom, who told her, no, he's here now. You're going to have to get a train and come up to Buffalo. So my mom spent the night in a hotel in Manhattan and wrote a postcard from the desk in the hotel room to her family saying she was having a great vacation and she loved them very much. And when they didn't find her in Indianapolis, my dad showed that postcard and that search was on to go across all of those states that she had traveled on the train and to go to New York City and engage the detectives there. So you had the police in Indianapolis and New York and the FBI all looking for her. And my grandfather went to New York to help them look for her. He felt that he had to be there because she was his special favorite daughter. And they called him in to tell him that they had canvassed all the hospitals, all the morgues. They had walked through the neighborhood where that hotel was to all the shops and restaurants. And the hotel clerk remembered seeing her, but she was gone and he didn't know where. They told him they were closing the case and labeling her a victim of foul play, which meant there was no body. So she had either been murdered or sold into white slavery. And that's what her family lived with for over 36 years.
Mm. It's hard to imagine such heartbreak, and especially the heartbreak of not knowing. I mean, that made the pain even deeper. And I find myself also so moved and saddened by the specter of her father, it would be your grandfather, going to a city as large as New York City and somehow thinking that he might be able to find her in this sprawling metropolis. I mean, probably
he'd
not under...
He'd never been any place big and bustling like New York City.
Right.
But
He could not have understood how impossible.
He didn't have any special investigating skills or contacts. He just was a desperate dad looking for his precious daughter.
Hmm. We're speaking with E. Dolores Johnson. Her memoir is called Say I'm Dead, a Family Memoir of Race, Secrets, and Love. As we've been talking, her parents were a mixed marriage. She was white, he was black, and they made the decision, the difficult decision, to, in a sense, run away together to get married, and she made the decision to, in a sense, cut all ties from her own white family, believing they could not possibly understand what she was doing or allow it to occur. And so she, in a sense, cut all ties whatsoever and to begin this new life with Dolores Johnson's father. I want you to say something about the moment when it occurred to you that you really knew nothing at all about your mother's own family. And I suppose along the way, there were probably these little moments where that would be evident that your mother did not want to talk about her own family or never mention them whatsoever. But then there's all kind of a big, fairly dramatic moment where it really hits you just what an unknown that is her own family. Tell us about that.
You know, when we grew up, my mother nor my father ever said one word about my mother's family. They simply did not exist. And we were involved in our community, in our church, in our schools, and our lives seemed complete. My dad's black family had a number of members in Buffalo, so it didn't seem like anything was missing. And when the movie Roots came on television, here's this African-American who, for the first time that I'd ever heard of, had traced his family back five or six generations and ended up in West Africa in a small village where his ancestors came from. The African who came to America as a captured slave came from that village. And it was just astounding, not only to me, but to millions and millions of Americans, because black people's history was completely cut off once they arrived in America. They didn't know their family name. They were people from all different tribes and languages and countries, and they had no common basis except that they were slaves, and so they became completely socialized into what their slave life was and not their former life. And I thought, wow, look at this amazing thing this guy has figured out, you know, what nobody has figured out. I think I'm going to study my family genealogy. And after asking some questions to my family in Buffalo, I decided to go down south and talk to other relatives, these ancient relatives that I'd heard of but never met, to get more details. And I went to visit this great Aunt Willie, who spent the weekend showing me photographs from my dad's family and spilling all kinds of unbelievable secrets that I suppose the family didn't want me to know. And when we got done, we had basically used her dining room table to spread out these photos in generations, and I was able to create a genealogy chart. I took some information back with me and had it all typed up on this massive piece of paper, and I'm looking at it one day, thinking about the people who are on it, and a major flash goes through my mind because I see that there is only one box on the whole sheet of paper with a white person in it, and that is my mother. And I think to myself, that can't be right. Where are the branches on her tree? Half my family is missing. I don't know who I am.
I can imagine what a striking moment that had to be for you. And, of course, that ultimately sets off quite an odyssey for you that is also a part of the story of this memoir. I want to have you expand upon a couple of things you say in the third chapter of the book, which you title Lonely Only, in which you talk, among other things, about the way your mother lived her life and carried herself. And at one point you say in this chapter, Mama was white but didn't live white. Tell us more about the way in which she lived and what she was like when it came to her own identification versus who she was to your father and to the community.
Yeah, my mother was a respecter of all persons. She used to say that racism was foolishness. And she didn't know what the big deal was about race in America. And as a white woman married to a black man, when it was absolutely unthinkable, she became, in my opinion, a sort of white woman because she was with us. We lived in a ghetto. All the neighbors were black. All the kids we played with pretty much were black. And my mom was dubbed by a neighbor as an honorary black woman. That was a compliment of the highest order, that this white woman lives among us, and she understands us, and she likes us, and we like her, and she's an asset to the neighborhood. And I asked my mom when we got in the house, what did she think about what that woman said? And she said, you know, it was an honorific and very well-meaning and well-presented. However, I am a white woman. I've always been white, and I'm always going to be white. And as the years went by, and we started many, many years later working on the information that went into this book, Say I'm Dead, I understood her finally. Because when I realized that there was a full half of me that I didn't know, the white side, as I say, I wasn't sure, having lived as a black woman, gone to a black university, married a black man, and so on, I wasn't sure what did that mean in me. And when I finally came to terms with that and embraced both sides of my heritage, then I felt complete and whole. I felt like people would be able to see me when I identified myself as mixed race, when they hadn't seen me before. They had said I was black. And my mom wanted to be seen as a white woman because she was a white woman, just as I wanted to be seen as a mixed race person because I am a mixed race person.
Hmm. One of the things that we read about is that even though your family was living someplace where mixed marriage was permitted, that does not mean that it was readily and easily accepted by everyone in the community. And you recount a number of cases in which you can remember icy stares from people on the bus or whatever, I mean, who would see you and would want their disapproval to be very, very clear. One story you tell was about a summer picnic in a county park when something really scary happened to your brother, Charles Nathan. And I wonder if you would mind sharing that story with our listeners about a woman who quickly came on the scene and tried to help.
Yes, well, we loved to go out to this place. It was called Chestnut Ridge Park. And my dad would grill, and there were swings and slides and ravines where we could go and hike. And just my mother loved the outdoors. It was just, you know, a great place where we would go with friends and spend from morning, way early in the morning until dark when the park closed. And during the time that we kids were out roaming around in the woods, my brother got stung by wasps, and they swarmed him, and they bit him so many times. He ran back to where my parents were, and he was on the ground screaming, and all of these stingers were in his body. He was just hysterical. He was a little boy, you know, under 10 maybe. And my mother was trying to help him, trying to calm him down, trying to get the stingers out. And a woman who was walking by, a white woman, was going to the rest area and passed by, and she came over to help. And she told my mom to mix water with the dirt, make a mud pack, put it on the stingers, and they would come right out like a toothpick out of a freshly baked cake. And it was true. And so my mom was able to assist my brother and get him calmed down. And the woman was, you know, very pleased to help. And my father came out from under the shed where he had been cooking to see what all this was about. And he put his arm around my brother to pet him. And the woman looked from my mother to my father and back to my mother, and her hand flew up over her mouth, and she ran like crazy through the park.
As though so horrified by the sight of a mixed
absolutely
race couple.
Absolutely horrified, disgusted, disbelieving that this woman was with this man and this was their child. She couldn't stand there a second and look at it.
So you are bearing this kind of impact of seeing people disapprove of your mother and father. And, of course, you were also experiencing the more, in a sense, commonplace prejudice against blacks that was still such a sad reality at that point in time. And so in some ways it was a double-decker sadness, a double-decker kind of prejudice that you were experiencing. At one point you say the quicksand of low self-esteem and of not belonging pulled at all of my family, and it could not be denied. I thought that was such an interesting way to put it. It helps us understand, in a sense, the toll that it takes when someone, in all kinds of ways, sometimes very explicit and sometimes more implied, is told again and again and again that you do not belong here or there is something wrong with you. Tell us more about that quicksand of low self-esteem. I think it's really important for us all to understand the cost of that.
You know, living with that kind of prejudice, where people don't like us because we're mixed and they don't like us because we're black, meant that it was continually in our face every day. We lived next door to a church, and people would come out of their church service and see us coming from our house and say all kinds of snide things and roll their eyes, and people would hustle their children over in a corner hurriedly so they didn't touch us on a public transport. And, of course, people called us all kinds of names all the time. That means that the security of being accepted and knowing that you can move freely and you can enjoy the things that everyone else enjoys, that you have the opportunity to mix and mingle, to progress your life, is absent. It makes you doubt who you are, what your worth is, or if you're ever going to be able to pull up and out from that pressure and that rejection to have that happy life, to have even a chance at that fullness of life. When we went downtown to shop, they wouldn't wait on my mother because she had us with her. They'd wait on everybody in the whole store. They'd walk all over the place to wait on other customers. When we went to church, you know, people didn't want to sit beside us. It was just constant negation of our being. And, you know, a lot of black people live with that today. That's why they're in the street. They're sick and tired not only of being rejected for jobs because their name on the resume sounds like it's a black person, they don't even get an interview, or they bear the COVID crisis with extremely disproportionate occurrences of the illness than white people do because of the health disparities in this country. It is something that makes your life so difficult. It's like having a job on top of living your life in order to get along, to try to make people see you, to try to have an equal chance to socialize, to go out into public places without people turning around to look at you, to be able to go on a vacation. My husband and I went to the Caribbean once, and he had on his tennis whites, and we were walking through the lobby, and this van of white people came, and they were ordering him around to take their luggage because they think he's the help, that black people can't possibly be in a resort in the Caribbean. It's constant, and it is so tiresome to your soul.
Right. And I think that's one thing that it's important to understand, the way in which that is a burden that is just kind of sadly born, and the damage that can do to a soul, and how that damage, in a sense, can be passed down through the generations and slows progress, and it slams doors, and it curtails dreams. There's just all kinds of ways in which this is a reality that we all need to understand. Beyond that, as someone who was black but very white-skinned, mixed race, this puts you in an interesting position where you would sometimes, in a sense, become privy to the prejudices of those around you, including coworkers when you were an adult, because they would share things openly, not realizing that they were talking to someone of mixed race and someone who had, for all intents and purposes, grown up in a black home in a black community. Tell us about that.
You know, one of the first incidents as an adult where I had to face that, I was working in a sales job, and one of my customers that I went out to call on was a car dealership. Now, I had been trained in the sales techniques and had a bad experience there where we were role-playing. You know, in this situation, this is the client situation. You go there, and this is how you're going to handle the sales situation. You're going to say this. You're not going to do that, and so forth. And so it was my turn to role-play, and I knock on the door and come into the classroom, and the teacher is going to pose as the client, and I start talking, and he abruptly pushes me to the door, and he says, "I don't want your kind out here. Go back to your office and send me a white man." So the man actually pushed me out of the classroom, and I was so furious, I wouldn't go back. And later he said it was a teaching moment because the customer is always right. And if they don't want you there, you don't stay there. And my position was I'm fully trained and prepared to do this job. I was hired to do this job. Let me do my job. Like, why is the company not going to back me in that? And so it came to be in real life that I had a customer who was a car dealer. And I went to his office. And he was on the phone with someone negotiating a car deal. And it was going on some time, and it was interrupting the appointment that we had. And he was trying to sort of apologize to me for the delay. So he put his hand over the mouthpiece, and he said, "Oh, these are niggers, and they can't afford to buy a car. You know, I'm just, you know, wasting my time, but you have to wait." Now, what am I supposed to say and do? Do I want my job where the customer is always right? Or am I going to say to this man, "What are you saying?" You know? This was the type of position I was put in many times because people thought I was white. And it really taught me that while people may smile at you and say something that looks pleasant, that's not who they think you are. They are putting on a false face. And I wonder how many really awful situations may they have agreed with or witnessed and said nothing about because they hold this low opinion about black people. You know, they say today, white silence equals violence. White people need to be involved in solving the problem, not standing by or pretending that they care when they don't. Mm. They need to get in the boat and help us fight for this nation that has a moral fiber we all hope is there.
I also appreciate some of what you talk about in terms of your married life with your husband, Luther, who sadly passed away a few years ago. But one of the things that you share is how often life would be complicated in terms of where you lived. And what that given community might be like. For instance, you tell us about what it was like to move from the Carolinas down to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which your dad was fearful about because this was going to be down in the deep South versus the South. And you write at one point, "It was hard for us Yankees to read the racial tea leaves in Baton Rouge. On the one hand, were the white friends we made and the sugar-coated southern hospitality most people heaped on their greetings. On the other was the bald-faced prejudice other whites felt licensed to spew. We decided that dichotomy was the ambiguity that comes with any changing times and changing ways. So we would not take on the jerks, but would focus on our fit with the best of the South's progress." I think that is so interesting, and to think about those kind of choices that, for instance, a black couple might have to make in a place like Baton Rouge, Louisiana in the 1960s in terms of how are we going to navigate through this landscape that sometimes seems to welcome us and sometimes seems just the opposite?
That's part of the tightrope that black people have to walk everywhere. Baton Rouge, in our own experience, was an extreme situation. But it's true everywhere in America today, too, that you're constantly encountering these very difficult, even dangerous situations, and yet you're trying to find and cling to the positive interactions in race that point us all in the right direction. It's this constant back and forth, back and forth. And you have to be on your guard, as we did down there, we learned, because shortly after we got to Baton Rouge, I started my job and had many very, very difficult situations. The first day of work, a white man came to my desk and told me a nigger joke. And later on, I had an employee who threatened me because he was a member of the Klan, I was told. And when we bought a house, we had purchased some new furniture, and it was just the first few days that we were in this house, and sitting there on our brand new beautiful furniture watching television when the banging came on the door. And because I had my nightgown on, I ran to the back to cover up, and my husband went to the door and he said, "Come out here, you are just not going to believe this." And when I came, there was a cross burning on our lawn. It was dark outside and we didn't know if anybody was out there. We were so frightened, and I went and called 911. And when the police came, they came in a lot of cars with their lights flashing, and a number of men in uniforms, and the person in charge came in the house and told us to sit down and wait while he first asked us some questions. He asked us, did we know who did that, and did we have any problems with anybody that would cause us to think that somebody was out to get us? And then he said, "Well, how long have you been here?" And we said, "We just moved here." And he said, "Well, where are you from?" So now his tone had turned, like, "What are you doing here? Who are you people?" You know, we have a New York accent, and he's got a Southern drawl, and it's very obvious. So the men in uniform fan out in the neighborhood, and when they come back, they're all out in the street talking. I couldn't hear what they were saying, but they're making all these gestures. But it doesn't look like anybody's very excited out there. There's nobody running around or shouting or trying to catch anybody, it looks like. So the person in charge comes in the house, and he tells us, "It seems like you must be good Negroes, because nobody in the neighborhood wants to make a complaint against you." I'm looking at my husband, and he's like very slightly shaking his head, like, "Don't say anything." And that's when we found out we had no protection. There were people out there that could kill us, and nobody was going to do anything about it. The policeman left without giving us his name or a phone number to follow up. And when my husband reached his hand out to shake it, the man just walked away. This is the police.
And of course, you are living with not only the prejudice that would so often be directed towards blacks in the South, but you are also bearing the prejudice, which was kind of a heightened prejudice, when we're talking about a mixed marriage, which many would regard with absolute outrage.
Certainly Louisiana was one of the states that still had that law on the book when the Supreme Court made all the states overturn them.
So explain your mother and how she chose to navigate these kind of difficulties and the effect that that ultimately had on you.
My mother was actually, you know, a wonderful role model. She didn't bring up race, you know, as a constant conversation in our house. She just wanted to have her family. She just wanted to get along with her neighbors and have her friends and have her job. And, you know, she at her job, she didn't tell anybody she was married to a black person. Otherwise, she would have been, she felt she would lose her job. When I found out the story about how she ran away from her family, I was pretty torn about that. Like, they loved her, and she loved them, and yet she left them behind. And only when she was very old did we have a conversation, when she was in her 90s, and she said that she had come to realize how much she had hurt her family, and she felt so guilty about it. And she wondered, you know, if she should have ever run off with my dad. And I told her, it's not my place to judge you, but the disgrace of your running away is not yours, it's America's.
Your book, of course, goes on to explore your efforts to reach out to this white family that your mother, in a sense, had left behind. And we'll leave it to our listeners to explore all of that. We should talk in our last couple of minutes about what is transpiring across the country right now. And I would be curious to know from you, your perspective on what we are seeing right now. Does this feel like a significant turning of some kind in terms of some of these issues and concerns that have been a sad part of our country for such a long time? Are we talking about some kind of new progress that is perhaps about to be made?
I certainly hope this is that inflection point that you describe. What we've done in the last few weeks with all of these protests is raise awareness. America has seen this rage boil over from all these years of abuse, all these people being murdered by the police, all this coronavirus, all these this poverty level, all of the people in the park calling the police because you're watching the birds or you're sleeping on the dorm couch at Yale. People are sick and tired and wanting this country to change. One very promising thing that we see is that something like 60% of the protesters are white. That was not the case during the civil rights movement, where you had some white clergy and a few other people of conscience that were demonstrating and helping. But now it looks like white America is waking up to the wrongs and their role in helping to fix it. But we have to go much further than awareness. We have to move into change. And I've been thinking about this because I was part of the civil rights movement and did a lot of demonstrating and social justice work in my life. And the Birmingham boycott, bus boycott, I think was 1954, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus. And really the start of all of the work that led to the Brown versus Board of Education desegregation of public schools in America, to the civil rights bills that were passed in 1964 and 66. And that was a span of 12 years of action to make things better Does America have 12 the guts to fight for 12 more years to overturn some of this system?